Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. Freak Show. Who hasn't seen the sign sometime at a dusty summer carnival on the outskirts of an American town, beside a tent with a barker at the flap entrance? Freak Show. Come in and see the amazing wonder of the world, whoever that might be, usually some poor soul with a physical deformity. At least that's how it appears to those of us on the outside, guilty and shamed for having stepped inside the tent. Who are these people anyway? How did they end up there? What kind of lives do they lead outside the circus? These are the questions Joe Richmond had, and he found an entire town that gave him an answer on today's program, in the belly of the beast, as it were, in a place in Florida called Gibbtown.
Melvin, the human blockhead, lives with his wife Joyce in a small trailer home just outside Gibsonton. In their living room, there are 8 clocks, all set 5 minutes fast, and a porcelain sign on the wall that reads, "God bless this mobile home."
Honey, gotta have that on 4.
48 a pound.
One thing to know about Melvin is that if you want to visit, the best time is in the afternoon because, he says, he doesn't like the soaps.
I watch the Prices Right in the morning, and then we have the Judge Wapner, you know, and then I watch Perry Mason, see what else is on tonight. Oh, Picket Fences, yeah, I won't be watching no movie tonight. That's one I really like, Picket Fences.
Melvin Burkhart is 86 years old, and for most of his life on carnival midways across the country, Melvin was known as the human blockhead. Being a blockhead means tilting your head back and hammering nails, spikes, and ice picks up your nose.
You want to see that?
I'd love to see that.
Okay, watch. Here's a 20-penny spike, 50-cent hammer, and a no-sense head. I'm going to drive a spike in my head. Watch. You can see that it's only entering a little bit there. But then as you hit it and control that hitting, it's going further and further, see?
Oh, gosh.
You've got it in there now. And then you can control exactly how far it's going to go.
How far is it in now?
That far.
What's that, about 4 inches?
I'd say it was near 5. You want to sit and measure it.
The spikes are real. The trick is they go from Melvin's nose down into his throat passage. As a teenager, Melvin was an aspiring boxer. But after no wins and 6 losses, Melvin's nose required an operation. 13 bone fragments were removed. It ended his boxing career, but Melvin says it allowed him to become not just a good, but a great human blockhead.
Everybody else now tries to imitate me. Don't get me wrong. I'm still considered the top, see, of the human blockheads.
Gibsonton, Florida lies on Highway 41 south of Tampa. The people who live here call it Gibbtown. It's a pretty small place, 2 gas stations, 3 restaurants, and a lot of mobile homes. It would be hard to tell that at one time this was considered the oddest town in America. The fire chief was Al Tamaney, the giant. The second deputy of police was a dwarf. The sideshow Fat Man was also the town's auto mechanic. And Gibsonton still boasts the only post office in the country with a special counter for midgets. If you want to understand how Gibsonton became the carnival capital of the U.S., the place to start would be the Giant's Camp, a combination restaurant and bait and tackle shop. It's the first thing you see when you drive into town.
Take care. See you tomorrow.
The sign on the wall advertises sardines, frozen squid, and live shrimp. Over by the cash register is Jeannie Tamaney, who runs the place.
Don't help me or I'll fall down.
When she's sitting behind the counter, Jeannie Tamaney looks perfectly normal. A new customer walking in for bait and pepperoni sticks would have no idea that Jeannie spent most of her life working as a sideshow attraction.
Jeannie Tomaney, the world's only living half-girl. That's all it is, ain't no more.
Jeannie is 2 feet 6 inches high. She was born without legs. Jeannie was married to Al Tomaney the Giant, who stood 8 feet 4.5 inches. Together, they were billed on Carnival Midways as the world's strangest married couple. In 1936, the Tomeinis began spending the off-season in Gibsonton. At that time, says Jeannie, there wasn't much here.
Oh, it was just all swampland is all it was. The whole place had to be cleared, and some had to be filled, and it was a lot of work. But we moved down, and all of our gang that was on the show with us and everything moved down. Sword Swallower and a fat lady and a midget and you know, people, sideshow people. And then they spread the word to other friends of theirs, and they all just decided they liked it. I guess you could say we were attracted to each other, because we all sort of stick together.
Every winter, the population of Gibsonton would double as thousands of carnival workers came in off the road at the end of the season. They came for the warm weather and the fishing, and especially they came because the town had voted in a unique zoning classification called residential show business, which basically meant that everything from concession stands to elephants could be kept in the front yard. But over the years, Gibsonton has slowly become less of a winter quarters and more of a retirement village.
Well, Jeannie.
Hello.
Hello, good looking. What's cooking?
How are you, honey?
When Melvin the human blockhead comes over to Jeannie's for a visit, the conversation always leads to two things, their health and the old days in the sideshow.
And they found out it was real and they confiscated it. Who was it had that, the famous half and half out on the West Coast?
Well, you remember Esther Lester, Rita Fred?
Rita Fred. Now, Esther Lester used to tickle the dumplings out of me. He's come, ladies and gentlemen, on this side I am the woman, on this side I am a man.
They trade stories about Grady the lobster boy and Priscilla the monkey girl. Melvin remembers the time he got Bill Dirks the two-faced man, a date with Mildred the alligator woman. The two ended up getting married. And because I'm there, Melvin and Jeannie talk about how they first got into the business, show business they call it. Jeannie started before she could even spell her name. Her father was an alcoholic. He ran off and left the kids behind. And so 3-year-old Jeannie became the family's breadwinner.
No matter what you'd made back then, it was big money. And when you had a whole flock of kids like my mother did, big money sounded good. And I would do a little acrobatic routine. I don't do it anymore, don't ask me. And I'd go from Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, all around there, those little fairs. That's how I got started in it. When I was 3. So many people say, oh, how horrible, how terrible. You know, I was 3 years old, and people came in, and being no legs, about yay high, and they thought that was great, and they'd bring me dolls and candy and gifts. And one of the men that had a miniature pony used to come out after we closed at night, and he would let me ride his pony. Well, that was heaven to me, any kind of a horse. So I had no problem with it. I enjoyed it.
Did you continue to enjoy it as the years went on?
Yeah, I did. I did even when we were on the road. We used to look the people over and say, well, this one looks like a doctor, this one, he must be a butcher, things like that. Because you had to keep yourself entertained. You couldn't just sit there all day long and stare into outer space. We had a lot of little methods like that that would take our minds off of whoever was staring. You know, the crowd looks at the freaks, and the freaks look at the crowd, and that's about how it is. You'd be surprised how many weird-looking people you can find in an audience. They think they're perfectly normal.
But around the 1960s, it began to get harder for the freaks and human oddities to work. Florida and other states started enforcing old laws, barring the commercial exhibition of people with deformities. And around the country, more and more people were objecting to the sideshows. They said the performers were being exploited. In Gibsonton, these people were given a name, the do-gooders. And to this day, that's still the worst slur in town.
Well, really, the do-gooders didn't do any good coming in to try to run our lives for us. They don't even know what they're doing.
And it hurt a lot of show business careers because at one time we had a little man called Otis Jordan that could roll up cigarettes with his lips and light it, you know, and he had little skinny arms and he had legs that were all screwed up, you know, scrooched up like that. He couldn't move them or couldn't walk on them or anything. But he did a hell of an act and he was excluded from a show when he couldn't work at all because the do-gooders had said he was being exploited. And he'd been on our show for about 10 years. He didn't have any place else to go. You know, he couldn't understand it. Why in the hell are they doing this to me?
Every once in a while, Mother Nature makes a goof and produces one or the other, and then where are they going? What are they going to do? But on this show, they could earn their livings, and very, very few of the sideshow people I ever heard of ask for food stamps or anything else or help. I'm very proud of the people I know that they do stand on their own 2 feet.
I had no qualms about introducing myself as a freak. It's the way it would be presented to them, you see. We wouldn't never get up there and just say, come in here and see a horrible person. We'd put it up there like, the fattest girl in the world. She doesn't do the hula. She does the hoochie-coochie on the inside. And you excite their curiosity to get them in, see? You wouldn't tell them you're going to go in and see a big, flat slob of a woman. You wouldn't go in there and say you're going to see a girl with no arm doing everything with her feet. You're going to see the armless wonder who does fantastic things right before your eyes, using nothing but the tootsies on her feet.
I don't know if it's a matter of they feel sympathy or if it's a matter of they feel superior because they're not that way, you know, there but for God go I, something like that. But people like it. They definitely like it. I think right now, if I was shapelier and better health and all, and went on the show with a sideshow with the same acts that we had, I think we would make a good living and earn good crowds. Really do.
Less than a mile down the road from Jeannie Tammany's bait shop is the Showtown Lounge. This is where most of the old-timers in Gibsonton still come to hang out. Tuesday night is karaoke night. Wednesday is the all-you-can-eat spaghetti buffet for $3.95. And every Saturday morning, a table is reserved for the Widows Club.
I just want a biscuit. Anybody want a biscuit?
There are 6 women at the Widows Club this morning, sitting around a big table with biscuits and coffee. When I first arrived just before 9 a.m., it's pretty quiet. But they all say, just wait till Monica gets here. And pretty soon she does.
She may not say nothing.
Well, hello. How are you?
Yeah, man.
Coffee with ice, please. Hey, you got your hair colored.
Well, I told you he cut it. He wasn't satisfied.
What did you get your hair colored for? May I ask you?
May I have some sugar?
Yeah.
Because it's gray.
So, what, are you on the make for somebody? Why can't you grow old gracefully like everybody else? It's the best your hair has ever looked, I'll tell you that.
Looks good.
Monica Barris is the matriarch of Gibsonton, Florida, and she presides over the Widows Club. She's 75, and like all the women at the table, Monica is retired from the carnival. In fact, this small woman with big glasses, wearing a dress that's just a few steps removed from a bathrobe, was for 40 years a carnival stripper. The Flame of New Orleans, they called her. But don't bother asking about it.
You take your clothes off. What the hell more do you want to know?
Let her show what she used to do.
Yeah, he was on the show with me. Remember that?
Yeah.
Used to line up, get the tickets, and they'd run out after show, get in line, get another one, back in again. Those were the days. Those were the days.
Over the course of a 2-hour breakfast, Monica goes through 9 cigarettes, 3 cups of coffee, and an order of hash browns. And in between, she talks a lot about Suki, her Pekingese.
My dog, when he gets his dog food, he looks at me and he looks up at the microwave. He looks at me. He will not touch that food that goes in the microwave for 30 seconds.
Everybody in Gibsonton talks a lot about their pets. In a town that over the years has been home to the alligator man, the monkey girl, the seal boy, the frog man, and the lobster family, people here treat their animals extremely well. Monica's dog Suki, for example, gets French vanilla ice cream once a week.
Show people are very, very good to animals. Very good. A lot of people always say, if there's a reincarnation, I want to come back as a show person's dog or cat. And it's the truth, isn't it? It's the truth. They come first.
In Gibsonton, they love animals, but they're suspicious when it comes to people, especially outsiders who are reporters. For decades, the media has come into this town to take their pictures and write Freaktown stories. The latest is a tabloid TV dream come true.
This is hard copy for Wednesday, June 30th, 1993.
On a cold November night in Gibsonton, Florida, Grady Stiles was shot and killed in his own living room. Not by some fluke of fate, but police say, by a hired assassin. Hired, they say, by Grady's own wife, Mary, and his stepson, Harry Glenn Newman. The horror that was Grady's life as Lobster Boy had ended in a hail of bullets fired at point-blank range.
Let me ask you something, Condon. Lobster Boy, in a wheelchair, arms and feet like a lobster. Now, how the hell could he beat the hell out of somebody?
He could.
They said he did. I don't know. I heard he was mean when he was drunk.
That's what I don't understand.
Now he's pushing up gauges.
The death of Grady Stiles, the Lobster Boy, has created a bit of a divide at Gibsonton between those who eulogize him and those who think he had it coming for, they say, abusing his wife and children. But there's one thing everybody in town would agree on. With Grady Stiles gone from the sideshow circuit, there are really no more human oddities still out on the road. The Lobster Boy was the last of the true sideshow freaks.
My thumb and pointer finger, whatever that's in, index, I think, is webbed, and they're short because of that. And there's a very large space between, I think that's my pinky. We haven't really figured that out yet. And it's got a very wide gap in it, and it closes like a lobster's claw or a clamp. It doesn't close like a fist.
Grady Stiles III is 17 years old. The lobster condition, limb reduction it's called, has been in his family for over 150 years. Grady's father, the Lobster Boy, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, and his great-great-grandfather all had it. And it's being passed on again. Grady's sister Kathy, and now her 3-year-old daughter Misty, also have the deformity. Misty has claw-like hands and no legs, just a toe coming out of each hip.
Come here, baby.
No, you're not.
Both Grady and Kathy grew up in the carnival and did their time in their father's Lobster Boy tent. But now, like a lot of young people, neither has any desire to continue in the family business.
To stay inside of a show is just boring, basically. Because you sit in there and you have nothing to do but perform to these people. You can't go out to look at the exhibit buildings or anything like that. You stay inside the tent. And I don't like that. I move around too much.
It has nothing to do with, like, people looking at you and,
no.
and you exhibiting yourself?
They do that when I go to the store. So that does... If that was the reason, then I would stay hibernating in the house 24/7. But I go out, I go to the movies, I go swimming, I do anything there is. So them looking at me because of the condition has nothing at all what to do with it. It's just boring.
That was the show train heading home. You know what they say? The season came, the season went. All my money I have spent. No cookhouse, no job, November.
Back in the late 1940s and early 50s, this country had more than 100 10-in-1 sideshows, 10 acts, one admission. And Ward Hall had some of the great ones. The World Fair Freaks, the Congress of Oddities, the Pygmy Village. With his trademark white suit, red carnation, and cigar, Ward Hall became a sort of Ziegfeld of the cornfield, a renowned sideshow entrepreneur, which, as he says, rhymes with pile of manure.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we are going to present Behind This Curtain, one of the strangest sights in all of the world today. Kashmir Singh, from Mysore, India. 4 ears, 4 eyes, 2 noses, 2 mouths, 2 complete heads on just 1 body.
Wardhall's first sideshow act was the two-headed baby. He bought two rubber dolls from a toy store, attached the heads together, slapped on a coat of paint, and put the thing in ink-tinted water inside a Tom's peanut jar. 40 years later, Wardhall says he remembers being at the Texas State Fair in Dallas when he suddenly realized he was running a traveling old folks' home.
I had elderly people working in that show. Oh, my God. In a very short space of time, I lost Emmett Blackwalder, the Turtle Man. It was just getting too much for him. And Bill Cole, the Quarterman, he died. The one tattooed lady died. CeeLo the Seal Man died. The one giant I had, Dave Ballard, he passed away. So I lost a lot of attractions in a period of a very few years there.
Christine, the girl with the alligator skin. Francisco Lentini had three legs.
These days, Wardhall still leaves Gibsonton every May to hit the state fairs and midways from Maryland to Missouri through Indiana, Tennessee, and Mississippi. But his World of Wonders sideshow is mostly just a museum now. Shabby mannequins and wax figures of sideshow freaks from days past. Ward's only touring live attraction is Little Pete, the fire-eating dwarf with a hearing aid in his left ear. Even the carnival barker has been replaced by a tape loop.
The pig-faced man and the mule-faced woman. Betty Lou, who had her baby sister growing from her abdomen. Christine, the girl with the alligator skin. Francisco Lentini had three legs. They're on the inside now. On display, there is no waiting.
In the early 1980s, the Smithsonian Institution marked the disappearance of the sideshow, calling it a uniquely American art form. But people like Wardhall and Jeannie Tammany will tell you, the sideshows have not really gone away. They've just moved.
Jesse, Raphael, Oprah, Donahue, Giraldo, to mention just a few. Human oddities today are extremely commercial, more so than ever.
The only thing that's different, they have so much garbage on TV that they don't need to leave home to see anything. You know, people used to be so hungry for entertainment that they would go out on a circus lot or a carnival lot, and they would wade in the dirt or mud or anything to see it. It was the entertainment. And when the circus came to town, it was the main event of the year. And now it's, well, there's a circus, so what? They're too sophisticated. The people are, I think.
Hey! I'm a magician. Anybody here want to see a trick?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
On one sunny Sunday afternoon, Melvin the human blockhead goes to an outdoor park in downtown Tampa. He's volunteered to do some magic tricks for the kids at a local fundraiser. Melvin reaches inside his cloth magic bag and pulls out a large pair of dice. He can make the dots move and disappear right before your eyes.
What's the two numbers right here on the dice?
5 and 5.
And what's here on the back?
2 and 2.
Now, if we knock the middle spot here and here, so it comes out over here and here, we'll have 2 threes, won't we?
4 and 2.
4 and 2.
No, 5 and 5 and 3.
You're mixing me all up. I better do it one more time so you won't be confused here. Now, boys and girls, remember.
How do you do that?
I think there's a trick in it.
It's an endearing scene to see 86-year-old Melvin the human blockhead hold court in front of a group of 7-year-olds. Over the course of his life, Melvin has logged over 900,000 miles, performed in more than 100,000 shows, and entertained millions of people. He's been a sword swallower, a fire eater, and a knife thrower. He toured with Ringling Brothers, he was in Ripley's Believe It or Not, and Melvin was famous in hayfields across the country as the human blockhead. But no one here today has any idea.
You want to see another one?
Yeah!
Like the little ones are running around, you know, chasing around after me, so they're just out having a good time. They're not impressed with an old geezer that's got a backlog, you know, going back to years and years in show business. After all, 86 years old, you know, you don't have a lot to look forward to in the way of performing.
When I place a rope around my neck, and tie it up very good and tight, something like that.
So I figure I'm very fortunate to get to this point. But my future is all behind me. I don't see anything to look forward to in the strict sense of the word. Just hanging around to see what's going to happen next, that's all.
Later that evening, Melvin is in the backyard with his 40-year-old son, Dennis, and a box of old knives. Daggers, actually. The ones Melvin used to throw in his early days in the carnival.
Right in the nozzle, right.
The two of them stand side by side. Melvin draws the knife up to his eye, squinting at the target 10 feet away. 30 years ago, Melvin was throwing these same knives on stage at his son. Now the target is a weathered slab of oak wood with the outline of a body painted on. And that's a good thing, because frankly, they're both a little out of practice.
Watch the head.
Ooh, that would have hurt him. That would have hurt him worse.
Melvin taught his son how to throw, and he taught his grandson. He says it's nice to think that some things will carry on. And then Melvin snaps his wrist, fast. The knife spins in the air and sticks. Dennis does the same. And they go on just like that for about an hour, until it starts to get too dark.
Hard shot.
Well, we better.
Yeah, here comes.
We didn't leave any laying out this time, did we?
No, Pop.
Gibtown is a Soundprint classic produced by Joe Richmond. The editor was Nina Ellis, thanks to Ward Hall, Ira Glass, and Sarah Kershon. Guitar music was by Paul Fish, former Sideshow Fat Man and one-time resident of Gibsonton, Florida. The show was mixed by Robin Wise. If you missed part of this show, or if you want to hear more, we have good news. You can listen to Soundprint episodes on our website, soundprint.org. Nearly all of our programs are archived there, and we've also got links to related shows and additional reading. The address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We always like hearing from our listeners. Let us know what you're thinking. The best way to get in touch is by emailing talkback@soundprint.org. Be sure to mention what radio station you listen to hear Soundprint. Soundprint CDs are available for purchase for a small fee. Call us toll-free at 1-888-38-TAPES, and we'll send you your favorite episodes. That number again is 1-888-38-TAPES, or you can order online at soundprint.org. Next time on Soundprint, two voyages of scientific discovery to Antarctica, 50 years apart.
These shells are sensitive to the acidity of the water. And what scientists have shown is that old shells, shells from the pre-industrial era that we can take from sediments, have slightly heavier shells than modern pteropods. So yes, we are seeing the early signs of this.
These stories next week on Soundprint. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.